Today we are rewinding all the way to series 2 and the episode What's a Urologist with Oliver Wiseman. If you're at the start of your journey and feel a bit like a rabbit in headlights, this is the roadmap you need. Oliver explains what a urologist actually does, when you should see one, why the pathway can sometimes feel so confusing, and which tests actually matter. If you're dealing with male factor issues, or think you might be, this episode could save you months of confusion. And as always, if you've got any questions, please reach out. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Hello, and welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Now, as Kieran and I have said, Series 1 was all about our stories, and our big aim for Series 2 was to get experts on. And of course, one of the main experts that any man facing fertility issues will come across is a urologist. And when we discussed having that person on, there was only one name that was at the top of our list, and that was Oliver Wiseman, because he has the dubious honour of treating us both. But, you know, he's played a huge part in bringing us to where we are today, and we are forever grateful. Oliver is a consultant urologist based at Cambridge University Hospitals and Bournemouth Fertility Clinic, and he's very experienced in the management of male infertility, and he also runs many training courses teaching other urologists. Oliver, as I said, we're delighted that you're here today, so thank you very much and welcome.
It's a pleasure, Sean and Kieran. Really nice to be with you. Really nice to speak to you again. And thanks for asking me on to the podcast. As I said to you both, it's something that I'm really passionate about. And so to be able to discuss it with both of you explain to people what it is that I do and how we can hopefully help in the journey is a real pleasure. So thanks very much.
Grand. Right, so Oliver, I guess we should really start at the beginning, because a lot of guys that me and Sean have spoken to, it is like you're a rabbit in the headlights. And right at the beginning, if you're lucky enough, you get to see a urologist. Some guys don't get to see them straight away. So I suppose, what does a urologist do? What are they and what do they do? What role do they play in this whole fertility journey?
Yeah. So a urologist is a surgeon who specializes in surgery of the urogenital tract, and that means technically the kidneys, the bladder, the prostate, and then also testicles and the penis. So it's quite a wide range of things that we do, and what you tend to find now is that more of us are specialized into certain areas. So some people who are urologists will specialize, let's say, in treatment of kidney tumors or bladder tumors, and others like me may specialize in male fertility problems and or other disorders of the penis and the testicles. So urologist is quite a wide term, and it's important, I think, if we're talking about male fertility, that as well as seeing a urologist, ideally men who have fertility problems should see somebody who specializes in that particular area.
Okay. I remember really right at the beginning, kind of being quite overwhelmed with all these words and new roles and things. So what's the difference between, because it will come, people will come up against it, is the urologist and an andrologist? Because it's something that came up quite a bit. Even it was just a discussion with me and my wife, Jen, and it took me a bit of time to get my head around the difference.
It's really hard for me to be clear about it, because the word andrologist, which really means male specialist, is used a little bit differently. So some embryologists or some of the lab staff who work in an embryology department, because they specialize in looking at sperm samples, they are also called andrologists. Okay, but if you're talking about an andrologist from the point of view of a medical doctor, an andrologist who's a medical doctor is normally a urologist who will then specialize in the management of as I say, normally male fertility problems, but also other disorders of the testicles and penis. Some IVF clinics will have andrologists, but they aren't medically qualified doctors. They're very, very able and qualified to assess a sperm sample, but they won't necessarily be the person who's doing the surgery or who's assessing the male patient.
Okay.
I see. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for clarifying that. And when a man faces kind of this situation where they are struggling to conceive and they go to the doctors, when is the first time they might expect to see a urologist?
Yeah, so Sean, it's such a long journey for some men to get to see a urologist or an andrologist. Typically a couple will have seen their general practitioner first. They may or they should have done ideally two sperm samples if the first one is abnormal. And ideally, they should be at least 3 months apart because we know that the quality of the sperm can be affected by things such as a fever or some other illness. And it takes about 3 months to make new sperm. So, you know, ideally, they will see their GP. They will have had two sperm samples. But then normally what happens is because the couple have been having trouble conceiving, they're then referred on through the gynecology route. Because at the end of the day, the decision normally is that as a couple, you're going to need to have some kind of assisted conception, so some help conceiving, and normally that's IVF for the couple. So often the couple then are going down the route of seeing a female fertility specialist or a reproductive medicine specialist, and they may not see a male fertility specialist as part of that journey. Some clinics will, such as Bourne Hall, will, if there is a male fertility problem, ask the male partner or the couple to see a male fertility specialist, but certainly not all will. Equally, some GPs also, as part of that referral pathway, will also refer patients to a male fertility specialist to be seen. So the pathways are really convoluted. I mean, Kieran described kind of a rabbit in a headlights, and the journey, honestly, for some couples is bewildering because of all these possible referrals, all these different people that, you know, you need to see, whether it's a GP, a gynecologist, they may see a urologist who doesn't specialize in male fertility, and then you end up seeing, you know, a urologist who does specialize in male fertility. And the, you know, amount of information that's given up to that time and what exactly the journey looks like can be really, really confusing, I think.
It was really interesting what you just said there, because I was looking at my, in preparation for this, you know, for us having a chat today, I went back on my NHS records last night to have a look through. And my journey started in like 2012. And it wasn't until 2015 that I saw a urologist, and it was you, you know, that exact thing happened. Of it was my GP that gave me the initial kind of semen analysis and discussions, which then led on to going to the gynecologist with my wife, and we were under that care until we ended up sit born, and even then it was very heavily still gynecology kind of based. I was looking at it last night thinking, why didn't that happen quicker? Like, why didn't I see a urologist quicker? What do you think the barriers are? Do you think it's the fact of there's just not as many urologists as there are gynecologists, and the workload is very heavy and it's hard to get to see one?
I think it's a little bit about the pathway, which is that if you're going to need IVF, it's all done through the female partner. Even in men where there's a few sperm, the idea is, well, there's enough sperm, we can, you know, move forward with IVF using that sperm. And the actual causes of a lower sperm count, and the opportunity maybe to improve that sperm count, maybe to mean that the outcomes of IVF are likely to be more successful, maybe to mean that the couple wouldn't need IVF and may need some kind of less invasive form of treatment, or even to be able to conceive naturally. So sometimes I think those opportunities are, I think that it's a big issue for couples, and particularly for the male partner. And I'm a real advocate, it wouldn't surprise either of you to know that, you know, if there is a male factor, that the couple should have the opportunity really early on in their journey to see a male fertility specialist. So, you know, a urologist, but ideally a urologist who specializes in male fertility problems. And there are, you know, quite a few of us around the country now. It's been something where people have been trained up, and there are a lot more than there used to be. And I think it's really important that men and couples understand that. And that's one of the things that I think is really important about your podcast is, you know, men are going to hopefully, through listening to, you know, episodes like this, understand a little bit more about what the journey can look like. And the fact that, you know, having a male assessment early on, if there is a low sperm count or no sperm, is something that they should try and ask for.
I think seeing someone earlier would have made me feel a lot more comfortable and enabled me to process things quicker as well. Because for a long time, I felt like I was on a journey with my wife, but I was the reason why we were going on that journey. And that's facts. That's the reason why we were. But if I'd managed to see a specialist like yourself earlier, I think that maybe I would have felt like my issue was being addressed.
Yeah.
'Cause I felt a bit in limbo, like, okay, we're on the right track to have a child or attempt to have one. But I've still got this thing that's wrong with my body and haven't really got any answers to why it's happened. 'Cause it's still unexplained now. I've just come to terms and accepted that. There's no genetic reason. I had my varicocele sorted and it didn't really improve much, improve the quality. Like my quality got better and numbers went up. So it definitely would have helped my mental well-being as well.
So I think that there are, you know, a few things there. So the first is that, you know, understanding what the cause of the problem is, I think is really important. But the frustration for patients often, and for me, is that in more than 50%, we don't understand, we don't find any underlying cause. We call that idiopathic, which is a fancy medical term for saying we don't know. and it is frustrating because, like you say, there's, you know, no genetic cause, there's no past history maybe of as a boy having a testicle which didn't descend properly, which can happen in some patients, or of having a testicle which maybe has twisted, which can also, you know, be an indicator in some patients. So for a large proportion of patients, we can't explain to them why there's a problem with the sperm count. And the other thing I'd say is that from a medical point of view and from a health point of view, though, it's also important that if there is a low sperm count, that men are checked over, because that can be associated with other problems. So you've mentioned a varicocele. Now, you know, a varicocele can for some men be troubling. It's a dilatation of veins around the testicle, for those who don't know. And that basically means that the testicle is surrounded by warm blood, and that's not good for sperm manufacture. And, you know, some patients may have been having an ache in the testicle. It's often on the left-hand side for some time. And they may not realize that that's something that can be treated or that can be associated with infertility. But, you know, a varicocele, Kieran, is something that's relatively benign. So it's not, you know, it's not harmful other than to the sperm count. It's not a cancer. But cancer can be associated also with male infertility. And there are some patients who I will see and examine, and I'll feel the testicles and they'll feel abnormal. And, you know, for those patients, it's really important that, you know, they get swift treatment and investigation of the cause of an abnormal feeling testicle, because it can be something that, you know, is a testicular cancer and needs to be managed and treated appropriately.
Yeah, that's it's quite a few things you've said there that are kind of, I think, really important. One of the first things is, I think talking to a lot of guys, they say a similar thing to what I just did in terms of my cause isn't known. And I think that's to come to terms with that is it takes a bit of time, but it's also they need to understand that I think understanding of the male side of the fertility world is just kind of really getting going. We've got so much more to learn. So we're in the early stages, and to kind of get that prognosis or told that isn't unnormal. To not really know the reasons behind it. I just want to say I remember that dull ache on the left-hand side quite well in my testicles. It's just like this dull, every lad's experienced it. You've been kicked in the balls, and about an hour later, you've still got that dull ache. That's exactly how it felt. So if anyone's feeling that, it's definitely worth going to your GPs to get a check. You've touched on kind of additional reasons why, you might be infertile. And cancer is one of them, isn't it? It's something that I think we need to promote on this podcast is regular checking of our testicles. Now, it's something we haven't really talked about much, but I can see us doing some work on it in the future. So thank you for kind of mentioning that, because it's not the best news anyone wants, but it can be really important, can't it, to kind of get checked and find out something like that that can then help you obviously recover and also help everything else that you're trying to achieve in life in terms of your children and things like that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the other thing that you said was that I think, you felt a bit lost and didn't really know, what was happening. And I think that's how quite a lot of patients feel until they see a specialist in the male side of fertility. Because I think there can be some mixed messaging from health professionals who don't specialize in that. And as you know, I mean, you said, I think it was 2012 to 2015. I mean, that's a 3-year journey for you and your wife before, you maybe got to have a definitive plan as to this is what's going to happen. This is how the road ahead will look. That's 3 years in kind of limbo, not really understanding what's happening. So, can an operation be done? Can't an operation be done? What's the cause of it? Is it something that's serious? How is it going to affect me in the future, apart from the fertility side? All of these sorts of things are questions which are going through in your mind. And 3 years is a really long time not to have any definitive answers or definitive plan for you. And the other thing with fertility is, during that time, the female partner is another 3 years older. Mm. If you are in a situation where you're seeking fertility treatment, let's say in your 20s, that may not be such a big issue. But because of how things are in the modern world, most of the couples that we see are seeking fertility treatment in their mid to late 30s. And, that 3-year delay or however long it is a really significant factor in I think, the, chances of conception.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And I think, it's... What can help that is the kind of early diagnosis of issues from other healthcare professionals as well. Certainly in my case, so we first started trying to conceive in 2017, but in 2011, I was doing those checks that we mentioned that every bloke should be doing in the bath or shower, and I found a lump and then went to the doctor, got referred on for a scan, and the sonographer dismissed it as, obviously, he was looking for a tumor. That's what I was concerned about. But he dismissed it as it's just a cluster of tubes. But that just a cluster of tubes was a varicocele, which, as we mentioned, can significantly impact a man's sperm quality. And so do you know if there's any kind of work going on to increase that awareness amongst healthcare professionals?
I'm a little bit surprised because most ultrasonographers would understand that what they're seeing on an ultrasound scan is dilated veins and would class that as a varicocele. I think that you're right though, there may be a gap in knowledge between a varicocele and the effects that it can have on sperm counts. The problem is, I would say, is that varicoceles are relatively common, but it's only really if you've got a significant varicocele. So that's one that isn't just detectable on an ultrasound, but one which can either be seen by looking at the scrotum from outside, so you know, big dilated veins that you can see through the scrotal skin, or one that you can feel when you examine the patient. It's only really those bigger varicoceles that we think are likely to be impacting fertility.
I certainly didn't have, it wasn't visible on the outside, and I didn't have any aches or anything. But it was picked up by yourself almost immediately, and I was already in the process of awaiting an embolization before I came to you at Bornhall, and then I underwent that at the UCLH. But unfortunately, in my case, I always say everything was meant to go the way it was because it led me to my children, but that didn't have any impact on my sperm at all.
Yeah. And it doesn't always, but you know, if there is a low sperm count and a varicocele which you can be felt or which can be seen, then very often the sperm count will improve once a varicocele has been treated. And you mentioned embolization. I'm not sure whether or not the listeners will necessarily know what that is, so it may just be worthwhile explaining that, if that's okay.
Yes, sure. Definitely.
So there are a few different ways of treating a varicocele, which are these dilated veins around the testicle. And embolization, I would say, is one of the commoner ways of doing it. It's a non-invasive way, and it's not done by a urologist. It's done normally by a radiologist. That's an X-ray doctor, because it's all done under X-ray control. And it involves, while you're awake, passing a very small tube through the veins of the body and then into the testicular vein on the left-hand side, firing tiny little coils. And those coils basically shrivel up the veins. And it's a non-invasive treatment, so there's no cutting, there's just a little needle puncture. The patients walk in, walk out, it is got a high success rate in managing to shrivel the varicocele up. And it's also got a low complication rate. So, you know, that means doesn't cause other problems from the treatment itself. So I think it's a very good first option where there is a significant varicocele for patients.
Definitely. Yeah. So we've kind of we've touched upon when someone might need to see a urologist and what can they roughly expect from an initial appointment with someone like yourself?
So I think ideally there's a bit of preparation that should be done before the appointment to make sure that the appointment is as effective as possible, because, you know, the patients want answers and I want to be able to give them answers. And I'm aware, as we've already spoken, that runway to seeing me may already have been 2, 3 or more years. So being able to give some answers there and then is very helpful. So that means that ideally we've talked about 2 sperm tests at 3 months apart. And to have those results, if the clinic hasn't got them, that the patients actually bring them with them. And then also, ideally, the hormone profile can give really useful information to me as to what the cause of the fertility problems can be. And the hormone profile is just a blood test that needs to be done. And ideally, it should be done in the morning, because that's when the testosterone or the male hormone levels are at their highest. And for me, I would want to have a testosterone level and I'd want to have an FSH level. So FSH is a hormone that's produced by the body that stimulates the testicles to make sperm. And if that FSH level is high, then it tells me that the testicles may not be making sperm normally. If the FSH level is low, then it says actually then it tells me the testicles may well be making sperm normally, but those sperm can't get out. So there's a blockage to the delivery of sperm. And that can be seen in men, for instance, who've had a vasectomy, or who've had some injury to the vas tube, which is the tube that carries sperm from the testicle into the water pipe. Or it can be seen in patients who've got cystic fibrosis. And in those men, they don't have the vas tube doesn't develop. So they will all have a normal FSH level. So ideally, I'd like to see 2 sperm tests. I'd like to have the results of that FSH and testosterone and have those available at the time of the clinic. And then normally it would be a discussion with the patient about any previous testicular surgery, any medical problems that may be relevant, and any medication that they may take, which can also affect fertility. And then I would normally examine the patient. And for me, I'd examine the patient standing up, because standing up is when those varicose veins around the testicle become more prominent. And then once I've got that information, I normally have a reasonable idea as to whether or not the cause of the no sperm count or low sperm count is due to a blockage problem, or a problem with a vas tube, or it's due to a problem with the testicles not working properly. So the testicles not working properly is non-obstructive. And then where there's a blockage, we call that obstructive. And if there's no sperm, that's azoospermia. And then based on that would depend upon what other tests I would then recommend to the patient. And sometimes we need to do some genetic tests to see if there's any obvious genetic reason for the sperm count being as it is. And that can be a check of the overall chromosomal pattern. And that's what we call a karyotype. It's a simple blood test. Together with that, normally if there are no sperm in the ejaculate, and we think the problem is a problem of production, then we would arrange for the patients to have also their Y chromosome checked. So the Y chromosome is a male chromosome, and sometimes there are small deletions of genetic material on that chromosome that we can pick up. And that might give us an idea as to, A, why there's a problem with the sperm count, but also that may indicate whether or not actually a sperm retrieval is something which is a reasonable option, because it's not always if there is a deletion of some material on the Y chromosome. So we do some genetic tests. And the other genetic test, if I don't feel any vas tube, would be a cystic fibrosis gene screen. So we talked about bilateral absence of the vas. And that can be associated with abnormalities of the cystic fibrosis gene. So that would cover the genetic tests. And then once we've had those done, we can then, or I can then outline a possible path for the patient and for the couple kind of to move forwards with their fertility journey. So it would either be an option for sperm retrieval, which I have to say is what almost all men that I see would want. So they'd want to go down the route of having some sperm, using their own sperm if that's possible, and it's not always possible. And then the other option would be a donor sperm, if they don't want to go down the surgical route. Or obviously if the surgical route unfortunately isn't successful, then donor sperm is still an option for couples in that situation.
It's a lot to take in that, isn't it? There'd be some guys listening to this and thinking, you know, just underestimating just how much you guys do and how vital you are in this whole role. If, well, in terms of plans wise, if you are putting a plan together for someone to move forward, if it was the fact of they had, say this lower quality sperm, would you be looking at seeing them again in say 3 months with a set plan on how to improve that, or how would that work? Or would you move them and say, look, we think that ICSI would be the most appropriate form of treatment for you to get them moving quicker? Like how would you kind of deal with that situation?
I think it's a really good question, because it's a balance, and the really important thing to take into account also in this kind of do we wait and see if things improve or not is the female partner's age. So that's going to play into the discussion which I would have with a couple quite significantly. You know, I think there are things that men can do to try and improve their sperm count. And I would say that probably the thing which I see most common would be a raised BMI. So men who are overweight or significantly overweight, and that can have a significant effect on the sperm count. But, you know, it's easy for me to sit there and have that discussion with a couple and say, it would be great if you could lose 2 or 3 stone. But, I know that it's a really, really hard thing to do. And I know it can take months and months and months. And from the couple's point of view, you know, the clock is ticking during that time. So it's something that, you know, I think I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say, look, this may help. Because even if the couple go down the route of IVF and ICSI, and there is some sperm that can be used, even if the man has managed to lose, you know, a stone or, you know, a few kilos, that may make a difference to the sperm count in 3 months' time of what can be used for treatment. So I think it's important to have, you know, the kind of holistic discussion as well, and not just rushing down the route of IVF, because, you know, that's a significant journey for the patients. And you want to give the couple the best chance of having a successful outcome from IVF. So the best quality sperm, the, you know, most sperm you can choose. So, you know, losing weight's important. A healthy lifestyle is important. We've talked about treating any varicocele that we see. You know, some patients I see, you know, the male partner is smoking. And, you know, that is really something that it doesn't help the sperm count either. And then, you know, regular exercise, plenty of fruit and vegetables.
We want to tell you about Impril, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Impril is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Impril by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, there's a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
There's a lot they can do, isn't there? That's a lot of things that they can do to at least try and improve that quality. Because that's one thing that I looked at it. I knew there wasn't going to be a drastic magic wand for my, you know, my sperm count to suddenly be at normal levels. But what I set out with the mission was to improve my lifestyle, just to improve the quality. So even if the level stayed the same, what I was producing was better. And subsequently it worked. It really did work. But it took time. It took about 18 months to see that real increase. And like what you've just said is, well, you've said it a few times, sometimes people don't have that time. And when all you want or what you're chasing it is, you know, to have a child, time can feel like it's your worst enemy, you know, because you're running out of time. So a lot of the data and research is suggesting that obviously fertility is on the increase. Have you directly seen an increase in, or is your workload stayed the same, shall I say? Or have you seen more men coming in with more issues? Is it becoming a more common thing?
Yeah, I think that we definitely know that, you know, sperm counts are decreasing. And the other issue is that, you know, couples, as we've already mentioned, are leaving it maybe later in life to start a family. And so, you know, fertility issues are definitely becoming more commonplace. You know, we have been, before I started at Bourne Hall, which was, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago, you know, they've always had a male fertility specialist there. But I would definitely say that the number of patients that we are seeing has increased. Whether that represents, you know, an increase in male fertility problems or just an increased awareness of the services that we provide, I would say it's hard to say. We have definitely seen an increase in the number of patients that we're treating and seeing in the clinic.
Yeah, because I read a really interesting article a couple of weeks ago, and it was just an article in a magazine. It was the fact of actually we're becoming more aware of what's going on. which is really contributing to the fact of the levels of infertility in society. So we're just more aware of it. And it was an interesting viewpoint for me, because I hadn't viewed it like that before. I kind of viewed it of, oh, it's increasing, which it obviously is. But actually, to think of the reasons why it's increasing, couples are getting older, you know, and yeah, people are more open to talk about it as well, which is another big factor, where before people kept it really to themselves. I remember having family friends growing up, and we never knew why they didn't have any children. But now, obviously, now I know more, and I can kind of make that assumption of why they wouldn't. It's not just one, it's two or three, you know. Yeah. So it's definitely society's changing, but also we're becoming more aware of it, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's where, you know, things like your podcast is really helpful, because, you know, it does encourage men to, you know, to talk about it and to understand exactly what treatments are available, and to know how and where to try and get those treatments. So, yeah, I think it's a really, helpful thing that you are both doing for the male population from that point of view. So thank you.
Thank you. Do you think, obviously the treatments are, you've said, are increasing. Does that mean that there's like more surgical sperm retrieval going on and varicoceles being sorted now than there was, say, a decade ago?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know the exact, numbers across the country, but bearing in mind that there are more male fertility specialists and we are offering, the most up-to-date treatment for whatever, whatever's needed from the patient point of view, I would say almost certainly that is the case. I think we've seen that at Bourne Hall as well. But I've got colleagues, in most of the large cities across the country who are providing, very similar specialized services to patients. And the number of places where that's available has definitely increased over the last 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. From the varicocele point of view, I think that, certainly we see a large number of men who have varicocele embolizations. You know, my colleagues in interventional radiology who I refer patients to, I think it's a significant part of the work that they do, and I'm grateful to them for offering that treatment for my patients. And I suspect it's similar, in other cities across the country as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you're utilizing the most up-to-date treatments. Are there any treatments kind of on the horizon that are exciting and that could have a big impact on the treatment of male infertility?
I think that the biggest thing, Sean, has been the introduction of micro-TZ over the last 10 to 15 years, which is widespread now in the UK in the hands of male fertility specialists. And that's really revolutionized the management of men where there may just be small pockets within the testicle where sperm are being made. We can, retrieve those small areas at microsurgical testicular sperm extraction or micro-TZ. And then ICSI, which Kieran mentioned before, which is where the technology on the embryologist side is absolutely phenomenal, means that, those individual sperm can be injected into an individual egg, because that's what ICSI is. That's completely changed the way that, male factor is treated. I'm excited about what the future holds. There's all sorts of discussion about stem cells and other treatments like that. But there's nothing I would say that's kind of mainstream or, likely to be mainstream in the next, few years. The whole, field is changing, and what it may look like in 5 or 10 years' time, I think is quite difficult to say. But certainly it's likely to be able to provide more options for more patients, helping them to become, mums and dads, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And certainly I had a micro-TZ, which you did. And like you said, more often than not, people will go for that because they want to go down every avenue possible and try every option. And we are very fortunate to live in this day and age where that is an option, and it does work for people. You know, in my case, it didn't. I really clearly remember waking up from the anaesthetic and having yourself and one of the nurses there to break the news. But I was okay with that because I had got to a point before that where I was in acceptance of what might happen either way. And one of the benefits of it was that I had the results immediately after waking up. I mean, for me, I just woke up and I was there. My wife, because I remember you saying before, it could last anywhere between around about half an hour and 2 hours. And it was towards the 2 hour point. And my wife said that the longer it went on, she kind of then was getting that inkling of what was likely to come. But it was, for me, it was closure. And I was able to put that to bed and then move on. And we then elected to use donor sperm, which, as I said, I truly believe we are being led to who was meant to be our children anyway. But I just want to ask a question around microtesis, really, because a lot of focus is often on the kind of the rates of sperm being retrieved. But is there any research and data out there about the live birth rates following microtesis?
Yeah, it's a really good question. But if I just rewind just for 1 second, just to say, you know, in my job, I feel really, you know, fortunate to be able to, you know, help patients on their fertility journey. But the thing which I obviously like the least is having those conversations with patients such as yourself, and I haven't managed to, you know, get them what it is that they want, which is obviously, you know, sperm to move forward the way that they'd envisaged. But what you just said, I think, is really important because, you know, it's a step in the journey for some patients. And it then means that, okay, you know, this isn't quite what we wanted. We understand that. But then, you know, we're now ready as a couple to move forwards down the next route of donor sperm. And we understand that we've had the most up-to-date treatment to try and find sperm. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, that's not worked out how it was. But, you know, let's close that door. Let's open the next door. And the next door for most men, I would say, is donor sperm. But, you know, you're right. The IVF journey is a journey of hurdles for patients. And where there is no sperm that can be used from the ejaculate, microtesy or a surgical sperm retrieval is the first hurdle on the journey towards parenthood. So, you know, you have to kind of then work out what the multiples are, because having some sperm doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to end up with a child at the end of the day, unfortunately. And I think that that's a really important message to get through, because IVF in itself, even if there was normal sperm in the ejaculate, you know, has got a success rate which varies depending upon the age of the female partner, is a crucial factor. And also dependent upon the clinic and the experience of the clinic that's, you know, doing the IVF. And so if you think about, you know, a rate, let's say, of 40 or 50% success per cycle of IVF, and then you think about a success rate of microtesy of 40 or 50%, and you start to multiply up those odds, then you're right, you know, a patient, you know, may well end up only having a chance of a live birth of somewhere between 15 and 20% once you've, you know, multiplied those odds out. So it is, it's a step in the journey, microtesy. Having some sperm there is a, you know, great start if that's how it is for the couple. But then there is still the hurdle of cycles of IVF or embryo transfers to go through, and they have their own success rates.
Yeah, and I think that's what I picked up on there, which is really important, is that it's what's right for the couple. Because I know loads of couples that have actually elected not to have the microtesy and have said, no, do you know what, we're ready to explore alternate routes to parenthood. And there is, what is right for wrong for you as a couple is the only right or wrong, because mm-hmm. we are blessed to have these options, but they are options, they're not mandatory.
100%, and I, you know, I never make any assumptions, because it's an individual decision for the couple. And like you say, you know, I can lay out what the options are, and then, you know, often it involves, you know, I think weeks, if not longer, of discussions between the couple, with or without the help of a counsellor, who I think can be really useful in helping to, you know, explore some of the feelings around, you know, what the options are. So if that's something that patients need, they should ask, because most IVF clinics will also have a counsellor who can be available to help explore some of those discussions.
Yeah, we spoke to the lovely Jackie Stewart at Bornhorn. Yeah. She helped us immensely.
And yeah, good.
Yeah, yeah, I am reading my notes yesterday. The letter that came from yourself, Oliver, says on it that I'd started counselling at Bourne Hall. So it was, you know, that's a very important thing to highlight there. And we talked about it a lot in our, in series one, about the value of it and how important it is. I can't explain how, just important it was for me, like, just to have that non-judgmental person to talk to, who I thought would, I could just offload everything. Really, really powerful thing. Yeah. So microtesia is a completely new thing for me. So like Sean's obviously talked about it a lot. I definitely think that maybe in the future it'd be worth having a deeper conversation about it, because it's such a, it seems such a wonderful resource and tool. And I myself have very little knowledge of it, apart from just conversations with Sean and a bit of reading I've done. But no, thank you. Thank you for answering that question, because I know quite a few of our listeners to do with microtesia have that question in terms of, you know, what is my possibility of having my odds of having a live birth from it. So obviously male awareness is on the increase in terms of fertility. What would you like to see, like, more in the professional world, or from professionals, what would you like to see done more?
I mean it's a kind of wish list, and it's you know, something that I think that we as male fertility specialists need to fight more for. But I really think that male fertility specialists or andrologists should be involved much, much earlier in the couple's journey. And, you know, some kind of multidisciplinary working, you know, I think that hopefully, you know, this kind of discussion that we've had will, you know, help patients to understand that that's something they can maybe ask for from their GP, maybe ask for from their fertility clinic if that's not something that's offered to them as well. Because you know, seeing a male fertility specialist, I think, is really important. But it's got to be earlier on in the journey, because going, you know, 2 or 3 years without that, you know, I think couples just feel they're a bit in limbo. And as I said before, there's no real, you know, map laid out for them as to, you know, what might or might not happen. So that's my wish. But as I said, the current referral pathways are all done where there's a fertility problem through the gynecologist, because the assumption is that the female partner is going to need to have some treatment in the end. I just think there needs to be a tweak to that pathway, so that if there's a problem with the sperm count, we get involved much earlier.
That you've answered the question that came to my head. It was, is that an issue with the pathway, and what do we need to do to that?
we need to
figure that out and put some pressure on others, I think.
that's some NHS bureaucracy that needs untangling, I think. So we probably need a bit of work to do there.
Certainly in my case, that pathway was a lot more defined, because I went to the GPs with a concern about my fertility, having had mumps or colitis in my early 20s. So I did have the kind of, I went to you and everything had been done. I had the two sperm samples, I'd had the blood work, the genetic blood work. Okay. I went there knowing my FSH and LH and testosterone levels. So thankfully, you know, I can say, and this was going back to 2017, it can work and it does work, but obviously there is always room for improvement. Now we do have a last question to end on, but before we do that, I'm going to read out something. So in a strange kind of quirk of fate, I now call a former colleague of yours is now a colleague of mine. That's Laura Carter Penman. So in the work I do to help men who are going through this, I now work with her. I mentioned to her that we were getting you on the podcast, and I'm sure she won't mind, but her reply, this is what she replied on text. And I don't say this in any way to try and embarrass you, but I think it's nice to know. Ollie is just the best. Well, she says, OMG, Ollie is just the best. He will be fabulous on your podcast. Probably up there for me as one of the nicest surgeons I've ever worked with. And I've never known anyone so passionate about his patients and invested in their fertility outcomes. So, as I said, it's not in any way to try and embarrass you, but I think it's nice to know that you're valued within the industry. But also, I think that's really crucial for listeners to hear, because to know that the people that they will speak to are really invested in their outcomes and their journeys.
Thank you. I'm super embarrassed, but I worked with Laura at Bourne Hall. She was the head nurse there for a number of years, and it was a real honor to work with her. She likewise has done a huge amount for couples with fertility problems, but I really enjoy my work. Looking after patients, it feels like a real privilege, like I said, to be able to help them on the journey. I think surgeons traditionally have had a bit of a bad reputation, for being kind of super overbearing and paternalistic, and maybe not being helpful in explaining things to patients and just making decisions on their behalf. And like hopefully we discussed over, the last few minutes, it's not how I want to approach things. And I kind of see my role as helping couples on their journey. It is an emotional roller coaster, that journey. Having worked for a number of years with patients, I just hope that small steps, explaining in a straightforward fashion what the options are and what the next steps are and why I think that's the case, hopefully makes sense to patients and helps them to navigate that that pathway.
Yeah, I think, and hopefully by the work we're doing to raise awareness and to get men speaking and show that it is okay, and you can survive through it and thrive through it. Hopefully you'll start seeing more engagement from men, and hopefully that may have already been happening, because to bring it back to the very beginning of the podcast, what Kieran said, I was that rabbit in the headlights as well, and that's kind of hopefully what we will work towards reducing for you. And actually, to kind of bring it back to Laura, in that quirk of fate, I've now had the opportunity, because she was the lead nurse when we were having treatment there.
Yeah.
I've had the opportunity to say to her, thank you for everything she did for us and for anyone else who was there. But I'm now blessed to be able to also say thank you, Oliver, for everything that you did for us.
No, it's a pleasure, Sean. It's just worth highlighting the point that you've made, is that it's a massive team who help patients on their journey, and they are super skilled, from the fertility nurses to the gynecologists, to the counselors and to the embryologists, who are doing that super detailed, really laborious work but behind the scenes. And so it's a big team of people who help patients, and I'm really lucky to be able to be part of that team.
Absolutely.
I'm just going to echo my thanks as well, because it's I'm lucky enough that I have a son now, and you played a big part in that, and I can't thank you enough that I get to see his smile every morning, and you've helped that happen. So thank you, Oliver. It's something that, sure, Sean said, we could never thank you enough. Thank you so much.
Yeah, those smiles in the mornings are great, but also I do have to kind of asterisk that with sometimes they just bring rage, pure rage. So thanks for that too.
Yeah, thanks for earlier.
You're welcome.
But that brings us nicely on to our last question, which would be, what one piece of advice would you give to any men out there who are facing fertility issues right now?
So I would say, try and have open discussions with your partner. Sometimes it is devastating when you get the results of a sperm count and you understand that the problem is with your sperm count, because it's a very low sperm count or there's no sperm count. So speak to your partner openly about it, and you know, don't kind of put it in the cupboard for a year or 2 years, because I think that's what lots of patients do and lots of couples do. And it doesn't get easier if you wait a year or 2 years, because then you've also got some, maybe some female fertility hurdles to overcome. So really, you know, go early, go and see your GP, you know, get some tests done, you know, make sure that somebody has examined the testicles to see, is there a varicocele? Is there something, you know, worse maybe that we've talked about? And then, you know, if you're able to as a couple and it's something that you want to do, then, you know, try and start that fertility journey earlier rather than later, and try and, if you can, ask for a male fertility specialist to be included early on in that journey. But while you're waiting for that, think about your own lifestyle as well. Think about what you can do maybe to improve things. And that might be things that we've talked about, such as, you know, healthier lifestyle, trying to lose some weight, giving up smoking, regular exercise, you know, those sorts of things. You know, even those small things around the margins, although it may not change what treatment you end up needing, it may mean that the treatment's more likely to be successful.
Brilliant. And actually, I was diagnosed with azoospermia from the outset, and that never changed. But to add to that point, I did make those lifestyle changes to try and do anything I could and to try and control anything I could. And that helped so much mentally as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, because you take some control of the situation then, and a feeling that you're doing everything that you can. And, you know, there are no questions then, are there? You know, unfortunately, you know, as you said, we didn't find any sperm when you had your microtesy. But if you hadn't done all those lifestyle things and made all of those changes, you know, there may still be some nagging questions. What if, what if, what if? So it's really trying to make sure that all the ducks are lined up and do, you know, whatever it is that you can. So I think that's really important as well.
Yeah. That was exactly the route I took, and thinking that I had was that I didn't want any regret of something that I could have done that I didn't.
Yeah.
Thank you, Oliver. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.